Morning.
This is our second day of argument for the February calendar, and we are delighted to see you all, but we're especially delighted to see Deerfield High School students. Are they here? Then we are not so delighted. If they were here, we would welcome them warmly. And I'm going to, looking at the crowd, I don't think we have Cashton High School students. I thought, oh, we got Cashton. Good. Please stand so everybody can see you. Good. Well, welcome, Cashton. You may be seated. The Cashton High School students are here with us under a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. And this program is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We invite high school students from around the state to come to hear an oral argument. And if they decide to come, the students are sent material about the cases and might engage in other activities relating to the case or the court. And then, as part of the program, after the second case, which is roughly about 12:15, these students will meet with a justice of this court and discuss the procedures the court uses, not the substantive issues of the case. Everyone is invited to meet with the justice after the second case. Before I introduce the court, if anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary of the case. Go ahead, just raise your hand, that's fine. We have a lot of them. If not, we can get more. While the marshal is doing that, let me introduce the court to you all. On my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. He's the justice with whom you're going to meet today at noon, and you might be joined by several other schools, including Deerfield, Faith Christian, Marathon High School, and Madison Central Montessori. The seated next to Justice Crook is Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far left, my far left, is Justice Michael Gableman. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Brosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. That's the lineup for today. So we will call our first case 06AP2866, City of Milwaukee Post 2874 versus Redevelopment Authority of the City of Milwaukee. Representing the Redevelopment Authority is Greg Hagopian, and then Attorney Hugh Brown will represent the City of Milwaukee Post 2874 of the VFW, and then Mr. Hagopian gets 5 minutes in rebuttal. All right, counsel?
Thank you, Chief Justice and Justices, and may it please the court. This is a case of interest in all states because of the widespread acceptance of the unit rule in America. It is especially of interest in Wisconsin because the unit rule is embodied in our Constitution, in Wisconsin Statute Chapter 32, and in our Supreme Court case law. If you affirm the 2008 Court of Appeal decision, that will establish a first-of-its-kind unit rule exception requiring condemnors in certain cases to pay a second fairness award over and above constitutionally required just compensation. And it will produce an irreconcilable difference with the federal and state constitutions and with what our legislature wrote and intended in Chapter 32. those irreconcilable differences with the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, 1791, nor shall property be taken for public use without just compensation. Obviously, just compensation is for the property. Article 1, Section 13 of the Wisconsin Constitution, even more clear. The property of no person shall be taken for public use without just compensation, therefore, clearly pertaining to the property. Our statutes, Chapter 32, very clear, all presumed valid, none of which were ever attacked in this case. 32.01-2, the definition of property includes estates in land. Basic property law, the landlord's interest and the tenant's interest. 32.05(9)(a)(1), requiring fair market value of the entire property taken to be valued. Remember, property includes all estates and land.
Mr. Hagopian.
Yes, Justice.
I think what you're saying is that this not only has implications for the unit rule, but it puts a gloss on the Fifth Amendment and on Article 1, Section 13. And it seems to me one way to look at this is that just compensation can equal zero.
Well, that's what the United States Supreme Court said. It said when in the United States versus 50-acre case, when fair market value is nil, just compensation is nil. So our United States Supreme Court has already said that, and that is the case.
Well, how often does the Redevelopment Authority in Milwaukee take property and pay nothing for it?
Well, the justice and the court can take notice that we are living in hard economic times. Under 66.1333, the Blight Elimination Statute, the Redevelopment Authority of the City of Milwaukee, as well as other redevelopment authorities, have the power of eminent domain precisely to take blighted properties. How often does that happen? Not with that much frequency. In this case, it happened, but it can happen. Indeed, in that United States Supreme Court case, where our Supreme Court said when fair market value is nil, just compensation is nil, in that same case, the Supreme Court said if something is worth 55 cents but costs $5 to own it, deal with it, it's the compensation is nothing. Indeed, that was the situation here, because when you considered the roof that was in need of repair, the plumbing, the electrical, the asbestos problems, the ADA violations, the weatherization violations, all those things that made it legally unoccupiable, and as Judge Kremers found, which was not appealed, unfit for humans.
Counselor, the property wasn't assessed by the city at zero value, was it, when you took it? It assessed at $500 and some thousand?
No.
No? There was no assessed value on the property?
There was an assessed value in the year prior to taking.
And what was that?
That was the year 2000. What
was the value?
I believe it was $566,000. But in the year of taking, the assessed value dropped to $1,000. And under Chapter 32, the date of taking establishes the time of valuation. So the only legally relevant date would be 2001. And then the 2001 assessment was $1,000.
What was the reason for the drastic drop in the value of the property in 1 year? Did something happen to it?
Yes, information happened. The assessor's office of the city of Milwaukee, like other assessors throughout the state of Wisconsin, often, well, they do deal on a mass appraisal basis. They are in their office with limited staffs. They have information fed to it through transfer return forms and other market data. And they mass appraise based on what's happening in the neighborhood, what are the recent sales in the actual marketplace. And it is only when particular circumstances of a particular property actually come to the assessor's attention that the assessor is then able to shift hats from a mass appraisal standpoint to an individual appraisal standpoint. And when the assessor became aware that there were all these problems associated with this parcel, those problems were not ignored, and the city of Milwaukee, a different body politic and corporate than the condemning entity here, dropped the assessment to $1,000.
Was there, at the time the assessment was dropped from $560 to $1,000, was there a plan already in place by the redevelopment authority to take this property?
There had been a redevelopment plan against this parcel for some time. Yes, it was in place. It was recorded against the parcel.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Agopian, I guess I want to follow up a little bit on what Justice Rogensack was asking you. My understanding is that you had a jurisdictional offer here, and that was $440,000. And that there then was a hearing before the Condemnation Commission, and they found a value of $425,000. Now, aren't those all occurring about the same time as we're talking about here, 2000, 2001?
Well, on the date of taking was February 28th, 2001. So that's the magic date for valuation under Chapter 32. The owner of the property, the Maharishi Vedic University, is not in this courtroom, nor are its representatives. The owner walked away from the property. You'll recall the tenant sued in the 2007 case alleging abandonment. The owners are not here because the owners knew the property was worthless. In the apportionment case, Judge Sullivan determined that of the $440,000 total award, $300,000 was attributable to the property in question, 2601 West Wisconsin Avenue, roughly 4% of which was leased to the VFW, the 96% left vacant for 7 years. The other $140,000 that comprised that award was split on an equal basis, $70,000, $70,000, one for a completely separate parcel that was not leased to the VFW at all, as determined by Judge Sullivan, and in which the VFW had no interest or right to claim interest.
Was that a parking facility?
That was a surface parking facility at 601 North 26th Street. The Maharishi Vedic took the entire $70,000 for that surface parking and walked away. That property is not before this court now. The other property for which the Maharishi Vedic took the second $70,000 amount and walked away was for movable personal property within the 96% abandoned space in the building, not leased to the VFW. That was all Maharishi Vedic's property, not leased to the tenant, and in which the tenant had no claim. So, yes, there was a $440,000 award. $300,000 of it was apportioned for the fee simple absolute estate. The owner walked away from that, allowing the 4% tenant to take the entire fee simple absolute estate award of $300,000. Now, the VFW took a gamble. It wanted to better that amount. So it went to the Condemnation Commission under Chapter 32, and in gambling, it lost, because the Condemnation Commission reduced the $300,000 award to $285,000, meaning that there was a $15,000 drop. Then, when the VFW gambled again, by challenging that $285,000 award. It went to the circuit court in this case, and it's gambled. The risk materialized in that gamble, and the VFW lost again because a unanimous jury reduced the just compensation to zero, realizing, as the VFW knew and admitted to other courts, that the building was worthless.
What was the land worth?
I would have to look in the record for the land value, but the cost of dealing with the problems of the building itself far outweighed any land value. So, like the United States Supreme Court said, if it costs $5 to acquire 55 cents, when fair market value is nil, just compensation is nil.
What was the redevelopment authority's plan? Why did they take this property in the first place?
First of all, we have to realize that there are two condemnations at play here. One, in the eminent domain sense of the word, and two, in the unfit for human sense of the word. This building was raised as being unfit for human. That's the conventional law. That building is going to be condemned. It's falling apart. That sense of the word. The Redevelopment Authority had marked the block as legally blighted and in need of rehabilitation and redevelopment. Now, the record plainly shows that Marquette University walked away from this property. It was too far west of the campus. It sold to the Maharishi Vedic. The Maharishi Vedic left it abandoned for 7 years.
And when did the Maharishi know there was going to be a redevelopment plan?
Redevelopment plans per statute are recorded against the title. The Maharishi Vedic, and I'd have to double check the exact timing of the redevelopment plan vis-a-vis Vedic's acquisition. If the redevelopment plan preceded Vedic's acquisition, then it would appear against title in any title search as an encumbrance against title, much like a restrictive covenant. If the redevelopment plan was put in play during Vedic's acquisition, which I believe did not happen, I think they acquired subject to, but if they would have acquired, if the plan would have been put in place during Vedic's ownership, then notice of the implementation or proposed adoption of the plan would have been given. Parties would have been allowed to come and review the plan and protest. That did not happen here.
Suppose I said the Maharishi Vedic didn't know there was a redevelopment plan at the time they acquired the building. Is that false?
I believe it is. I would have to double check on the timing of the plan versus the ownership. But I believe it is.
Well, then why on earth would they have paid $600,000 for a building that was going to be condemned?
Charles Ingberg, noted architect and expert witness in our case, testified in the trial court that as a personal favor to Maharishi Vedic representatives, do not buy this property. It is not worth any money you will acquire it for. It is plagued with so many problems, you will regret your decision. Don't buy it. That was his advice to the Maharishi Vedic University representative in Wisconsin. That representative did not listen to his advice. And when the Maharishi Vedic took ownership, it brought in several representatives in an attempt to deal with the many then-existing code violations in the property. Those representatives stayed on site and quickly left because they were not able to legally occupy the 96% of the non-lease space because of the code problems, and they realized that there was no way they could tackle the code problems. Sometimes you have owners that do, or buyers, that do very foolish things and that overpay. I think the fact that Vedic acquired at any price turned out to be a very bad decision. It was not able to obtain occupancy permits for any of the 96% space despite its efforts. It was not able to deal with the code problems. And as the VFW itself alleged in its 2007 landlord case, it abandoned the property. Now, think what happens to an 11-story, 113,000-square-foot commercial building on 26th and Wisconsin when it is abandoned, but for 4% of leased space in the basement. That abandoned space, as you can imagine, was then subject to vandals, to broken windows, to freezing water pipes, to deterioration, to decay over 7 years.
May I ask, under the terms of the lease, the post members and their guests were entitled to 20 parking spots, right?
Yes.
Where were those parking spots?
Those were not at 601 North 26th Street, the separate parcel that Vedic got the $70,000 for. Those were in an attached parking ramp attached to the tower itself, which was abandoned during Marquette University's tenure because it was falling apart. So the VFW, after a while, became unable to use that attached parking ramp. The parking ramp itself became unusable.
Tell me about the obligation to redecorate at least every 7 years and pay all real estate taxes. Wasn't the VFW left with paying the taxes out of their portion?
Well, under Chapter 32, the Redevelopment Authority, under our Constitution and Chapter 32, the Redevelopment Authority pays a unit rule value, one award for the fair market value into court, and it is entitled to deduct from that payment the lien of outstanding taxes so that the Redevelopment Authority may remit those to the taxing body, because a lien of property taxes is a superior lien. The legislature recognizes that, and the legislature provided in Chapter 32 for that offset.
Okay, so what you're saying is if they have a claim regarding taxes or refurbishing the property, that's against the entity that owned the property, and it's nothing to do with the unit value.
Yes, and thank you for raising that, because while we are also dealing with true condemnation here, the eminent domain and the Rays, we are dealing also with really three lease terminations. One is the legal termination of the lease by virtue of the operation of eminent domain. Midwest 2 says that, and as are many other cases. So eminent domain terminates the lease. The second is the Judge Kremer's ruling determining that the building is unfit for humans and ordering it razed. As a practical matter, if you are entitled to 4% of the square footage in a building that is knocked down because it is unfit for humans, as a practical matter, what value is your lease? And the third termination of the lease is by the express terms of the lease itself, something that really none of the other courts have focused on. The express terms of the lease provide that if the VFW ceased to occupy the premises and no other comparable veterans organization operated the premises, then the tenant's interest in the real property would revert to the landlord. That happened here. The VFW ceased to occupy the property. No comparable veterans organization occupies that property. Hence, any interest the tenant would have had reverted to the landlord. So there are three real terminations of the lease: eminent domain, the raising of the building, rendering this all moot, And the third, the operations of the lease, the express terms of the lease itself. And those express terms of the lease really render the lease of no market value anyway.
When did they get out of the building, the VFW?
When they were ordered to do so by Judge Kremers because it was unfit for human occupancy, unsafe. Our building inspectors...
They were in there until that order?
Well, there's a procedure in Chapter 32 that provides for eminent domain acquisition. Post-acquisition... Now, let me bring up the Midwest 2 Janesville case. In that case, there was a tenant, the trucking operator. In that case, the trucking operator tenant's lease was terminated by eminent domain. And in that case, the tenant held over. Under 32.05 sub 8, when a tenant holds over in a terminated lease of the taken property, the condemnor may go to court for a writ of assistance to oust the tenant. The requirement, however, is that the condemnor must identify, not pay for, Dottie, Midwest 2, identify, not pay for, a comparable replacement property. In this case, the Redevelopment Authority did that. Judge White determined that the Redevelopment Authority did that. That issue went up on appeal. In the 2003 Court of Appeals case, the Court of Appeals said that that whole 3205 sub 8 writ ouster issue was moot because of the raising of the building. And so too, shouldn't this whole case be moot because of the whole raising of the building? In any event,
it seems to me somewhat curious that you are saying the provision of the lease about the exiting of VFW applies after they're forced out of the building. I mean, I'm kind of taken aback by that.
Let's even go pre-taking. If this were pre-taking, and if the VFW wanted to market its leasehold interest on the open market, well, what kind of buyers would come there? First of all, the buyers of the leasehold interest, really subtenants, or assignees of the lease, would come to the VFW and say, well, I'm interested in this 5,250 square foot space, but first of all, I want to see the terms of your lease. By looking at the terms of the lease, the assignee or proposed assignee would see that the premises could only be used for veterans' purposes and that the public was not allowed. So that really severely limits use. Also, the proposed assignee, way before taking, before any redevelopment plan, would see that the VFW could not assign this lease to any other person or entity except a similar veterans organization to occupy the property for veterans' purposes. Well, that will severely limit the potential number of assignees in the marketplace. Not only will a proposed assignee, and by severely limited the number of assignees in the marketplace, it will severely limit any market value of that lease or the assignment thereof.
Did the VFW lose anything of value?
No. Because if I lease to a tenant at a penny a year for 1,000 years, space in a building that is not legally occupiable and that is unfit for humans, that is not worth the paper it's printed on. It has no market value.
What has the Redevelopment Authority done with this site?
It has raised the blighting influence in the neighborhood. It is now a vacant parcel.
And is it worth nothing?
Right now, it is owned by the Redevelopment Authority of the City of Milwaukee. Redevelopment Authority is entitled to property tax exemption under the statutes, so it is assessed at nothing. There have been no buyers, to my knowledge, that have been able to put together any deal for the property. And I work very closely with the Department of City Development and the Redevelopment Authority. Besides doing eminent domain litigation, I put together transactions. I am not aware of any deal that has ever been able to be put together.
But let me ask this. Suppose the marshal down here, and I want to start a business venture. There's a nice piece of vacant property at the corner of Wisconsin Avenue and 26th and 27th Street. Mm-hmm. Should we build student housing there? How much do you want for it?
Many times developers come to us, and sometimes what the Redevelopment Authority will do, not being a private market player, will negotiate a deal. It may be that we will sell it to you at what the then value of that property is, if you're not seeking any sort of subsidy for your development. Many developers, however, are seeking subsidy or are unable to put the deal together without some sort of public assistance. In that case, the Redevelopment Authority oftentimes drops the price to a very, very low price, knowing that the development will then change the property from property tax exempt hands to property tax paying hands, from vacant unimproved status to improved status, thus enhancing the tax rolls, from there being no jobs there to being jobs there. And so oftentimes the Redevelopment Authority subsidizes that type. But that type of property is not what was taken on February 28, 2001. It wasn't vacant, buildable land. That's more valuable than an 11-story, 113,000 building loaded with asbestos, roof problems, interior problems, exterior problems, plumbing problems, electrical problems, ADA problems, weatherization problems, elevator problems, you name it.
Counselor, the Redevelopment Authority didn't fix all those problems. They just took down the building. It's got to have been cheaper to take down the building than to fix all that stuff.
And it was. And so the Redevelopment Authority did that. Because as it was sitting there on the date of taking, the building was an albatross.
But the land wasn't.
The building is attached to the land. Fair market value under Wisconsin law assumes a willing buyer not compelled to buy, a willing seller not compelled to sell, both knowledgeable about the property, and buying under normal circumstances, neither of whom compelled to act. So a knowing buyer of that land, knowing all the problems associated with it, even though the structure, the bones of the buildings may have been okay, the rest of the organs and flesh and blood and veins were all in need of work. That knowing buyer wouldn't buy the property. In fact, the Maharishi Vedic couldn't do anything with the property. It was abandoned for 7 years, unable to offload it in the marketplace, unable to occupy it.
Council, prior to their removal, was the VFW post still making regular and routine use out of their space within the building?
Of their 4% use, yes, to my knowledge, they were occupying.
Are they human beings?
Of course they are. Now, it turned out that after a while, when the placard card orders and raise orders came to be, that those human beings had to leave for their own safety. The City of Milwaukee building inspectors inspected. Ron Roberts testified. There were methane gases that were leaking in the building. There were dangling live electrical wires. One of the many concerns of the building inspectors was that that building could have exploded. So the city was very concerned about those human beings. And Judge Kremers was too.
Council, I think your time is up, and no one else has questions, so that completes your arguments initially, but you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Hugh Brown, representing VFW Post.
May it please the court, my name is Hugh Brown. I'm a member of the Milwaukee law firm of Godfrey, Brown, and Frazier. And I appear here, of course, on behalf of the VFW. With me at counsel table is Melinda Hine of our office. I'm pleased to advise you that in the chamber, the commander of Post 2874, Robert Drakos, is present. Gregory West, who is the quartermaster, has worked valiantly through this struggle, is present in the chambers. We welcome Wilford Johnson, the state senior vice commander of the State of Wisconsin Veterans of Foreign Wars, many other representatives of the state and local VFW are here. We're pleased to announce that we have veterans from WW2, Korea, and Vietnam, not to my knowledge any from Iraq or Afghanistan. The issue in this case is simply stated. Can the unit rule be applied to forfeit the VFW lease? The Court of Appeals addressed that issue and concluded that because the unit rule in this case forfeited a very valuable lease interest, it could not be applied to forfeit that interest, particularly under the unique and special facts of this case. Now, I'm not going to burden you with a review of all these facts, but there are some facts that are crucial. Number one, in 1994, the Maharishi Vedic University purchased this property from Marquette University for $600,000 and made the commitment to fulfill the terms of this very burdensome lease. Was it a matter of concern at the time of that transaction? It certainly was, because in our appendix, page 127, you will see uniquely Marquette University took special measure at the time of that conveyance to make sure that the Maharishi Vedic University understood that it had the obligation to meet the terms of that lease. That was a significant component of that acquisition. Fact number two, the Maharishi never occupied the building. The record is not clear as to why. Originally, they were going to use this as some sort of assembly facility. You understand the Maharishi Vedic University is part of an international organization advancing transcendental meditation. Somehow it decided after it purchased this property that it was not going to be used. But it is interesting that they met the response just as Marquette did, and just as the Maharishi met the responsibilities of maintaining this 5,250 square feet on the lower level of this property.
Was there some point when they stopped paying taxes? Was there some point when they stopped paying taxes?
I don't think so. I think the taxes at the closing on February 28, 2001, I don't believe that the Maharishi was delinquent in his taxes.
I thought your brief indicated that the $300,000 that was assigned to the VFW was minus taxes owed.
Yes, it is, but that's fairly routine because that award was made on February 28th of 2001 and the 2000 taxes had not been paid. To that extent, some taxes may have been delinquent, but I believe the 1990 taxes were paid, the 2000 taxes were still due, really. And at the time of acquisition, all of those taxes had to be paid. I'm not sure, and I don't think the record discloses, whether the Maharishi paid the initial installment in January. That's possible. But that issue of the Maharishi paying the taxes, I don't think is involved. When
Let me move on to something else. You were involved in the Luber case.
Right.
In that case, you had some renters, and they had noticed that the property was going to be taken, so they pulled out.
Right.
In this case, did the Maharishi have notice, and when, if so, that this property was going to be taken, so that it would be kind of foolish to put money into it?
I don't think there's any question that this point that we're addressing here is critically important, because while counsel may have forgotten, in 1998, the record discloses that the Redevelopment Authority of the City of Milwaukee developed a redevelopment plan for this property. And that redevelopment plan provided for the raising of all the buildings on the property. Now, why would the Maharishi maintain the building when the Maharishi knew that building was going to be torn down? This building, and I guess this is fact number three of significance, this building, all parties agreed, was structurally sound. It's a reinforced concrete building that was only 40 years old. Now, it's the responsibility of the Department of Neighborhood Services of the City of Milwaukee to require the owner of that property to maintain it code compliant. And that lease requires that the Maharishi maintain this property code compliant. Where was the City of Milwaukee in the enforcement of its own code? It did not enforce that code because it wanted to tear the building down. Now, that is crucial as to how the Court of Appeals disposed of it, because I think they understood that it was the inaction of the City of Milwaukee in not enforcing the code on a structurally sound building that caused the abandonment of this building. That's the reason why the Maharishi never went forward.
Well, it was the obligation of the Maharishi to maintain that building.
Yes,
regardless of
right.
Redevelopment. Yes. And they had an obligation under the assignment of the lease.
No question. Which Marquette emphasized by a separate document.
Right.
And yet they didn't do it. And when the VFW went to the city and said, this building has been vacant since 1994, send somebody out there to at least improve the appearance of it, fix the plumbing and the heating. The Maharishi abandoned that building. And the record is not absolutely clear, but it was somewhere they acquired it in 1994. 1995, 1996, they left that building that was vacant.
Well, couldn't the VFW sue the Maharishi?
Absolutely, and Your Honor, that's exactly what we did.
Okay.
That when we
that
got
happened.
To the point where you know, we saw this coming from the very beginning. We knew that they were going to try to limit our recovery on the basis of the value of this building. So, in 2005, October of 2005, I commenced an action against the Maharishi, Marquette, and Town Realty.
It's pretty ecumenical. I said it was pretty ecumenical, counsel.
Right. It suggested that I should have the judgment not to sue Marquette and Joe Zilber in the same lawsuit. I did do that because, and this is a crucial part of this case, if they want to apply if the city wants to apply the unit rule, that's fine. Just so long as the VFW retains the right to sue the defaulting lessor. But there's a combination of rules here. There's the unit rule, and then the rule that in condemnation, the condemnation terminates the obligations between the lessor and the lessee. Judge Fiorenza dismissed that case, first against Town Realty and Marquette, and then on summary judgment against the Maharishi, and imposed $18,000 and sanctions against me for bringing that action. I invite you to examine that record carefully, because it is true that a strict application of the unit rule is acceptable, just so long as you don't enforce the collateral rule, which prevents the lessee, in this case, from suing the lessor for an obvious breach of lease. But that happened in this case. And I think the Court of Appeals understood that when they reviewed that. They said, if you're going to do this under these circumstances, this is a violation of the Constitution.
Mr. Brown, as I understand this, you are asking us to make an exception for the unit rule, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And you and I both know once you start making exceptions, you can continue on making exception, 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 and then the unit rule's gone, right? That's the danger. So how would you frame an exception to the unit rule that you think is wide enough to cover the VFW but narrow enough to retain the unit rule?
Your Honor, I'm in favor of retaining the unit rule. I think it's a sensible rule. There's no reason why the condominor should pay more for a building than it's worth.
Okay.
In my experience on both sides of the condemnation field, I have found the unit rule to be more administrative rule to accommodate the condominors. There's no reason why we should impose upon condominors the obligation to sort out all of the various interests in a piece of real estate. But when you get to the point where you use the unit rule to forfeit an interest in property, that is impermissible. Now, the significant development that this court has advanced is in the Wisconsin Mall case. Up until the Wisconsin Mall case, after condemnation, you could not sue a lessor, or a lessor could not sue a lessee. Very significant advancement in the law set out in the Wisconsin Mall case, in which this court decided that after condemnation, the Wisconsin Mall could sue Saks, and did. If that law would have prevailed, Your Honor, in this case, we would have had no problem. But you understand that alternative remedy was pursued. The Wisconsin Mall case was in process in October of 2005, and when Judge Fiorenza dismissed it in 2006, but it wasn't. The Wisconsin Mall case was not decided by this court until July 11th of 2006. So there was never any understanding that the court had recognized the right of a lessor and a lessee to sue each other for breach of contract before the condemnation and carry on that action after the condemnation occurred. That's crucially important, and that is the justification for making an exception to the unit rule. Why? We make an exception to the unit rule, and I think that's in the Court of Appeals decision. They recognized that I could not bring an action against who is the culpable party here. The culpable party is the Maharishi, Marquette, and Tom Reilly. They're the ones that made this commitment to the VFW. And yet, in bringing an action against them, not only did I lose that action, but was sanctioned for reasons that are unclear. Now that you've removed that barrier, I would say, let us preserve the unit rule. And it's one of the benefits, I think, of this case, that we can go forward now with this court having a consistent policy saying, let the unit rule be strictly enforced. But,
Mr. Brown, I understand in the bigger picture what you're talking about. You can go this way or you can go this way if you have a remedy over here.
Right.
But aren't you, in effect, shifting the shaft, so to speak, from the Maharishi to the Redevelopment Authority?
Well, I think that's right. But I guess the unconstitutionality of the court, as the Court of Appeals saw this, is you can't have both of those rules, because if you apply both of those rules, you're going to deny this person the right to a remedy. Now, it is true that as long as the Fiorenza decision was appealed to the Court of Appeals and this court denied review, that remedy is gone. That indeed, I agree, does shift the responsibility to the Redevelopment Authority. On the facts, though, we shouldn't be concerned about this, because, and the Court of Appeals understood this, while the Maharishi was primarily responsible, along with Marquette and Tom Wheeler, the city had significant responsibility, because they declined to enforce the code. And it is that failure to enforce the code that reduced the value of the building so that on date of taking, there was not sufficient value there to compensate the VFW for its lease.
What case says you can sue the city because the city doesn't enforce the code? I mean, that's what you're saying.
Yes.
You're saying, city, you didn't enforce the code, you are liable. Well, the city doesn't enforce a lot of laws. It's a discretionary issue, just like traffic officers don't enforce every violation that they see. These are discretionary acts. And what makes the city liable for failing to require a city owner, a property owner, to not to remove the snow if somebody falls? You sue the city, you sue the property owner. So what do you do? Now, you may have been wrong about your suit. You may or may not have been wrong about your suit, but that against the Maharaj, but that's gone.
That is gone.
That's right. So is the rule of law that you can sue the city if you lose your suit against the landlord?
I don't think that's the thrust. I would agree that we can't sue the city to make them enforce the code.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, we made some gestures. The quartermaster was constantly after the city to get them to come in and correct some of these defects. And they didn't get any response. Why? I'm going to tear the building down. So the city, I'm not saying that I could make them liable, but they have a responsibility here. And the ugly part of this factually is that they declined to exercise a responsibility because it served their best interest. They knew that if they let this building deteriorate, on date of taking, they would pay substantially less than they would if they had maintained the code. Now remember,
Counselor, I want to change your focus a little bit here. I don't see this case as whether the city was a bad guy or a good guy, or the Redevelopment Authority was a bad guy or a good guy. What troubles me is, did the VFW receive just compensation? That's where my mind is. I'm not sure about the rest of the court here. And as I understood what was briefed, it was my understanding that you believed they had not received just compensation. And the culprit here was the way the unit rule was enforced against the veterans. So what I'd like you to do for me is focusing on just compensation, not how bad the city was or the other lawsuit. How do you think this court should adjust the unit rule so the veterans will receive just compensation?
Well, I think just exactly what the Court of Appeals did. They said, under the facts of this case, we are not going to permit the unit rule to be used to forfeit a valuable lease. Now, the fair market value, you understand, of the VFW lease has never been determined. At the very outset, when this thing went to the Condemnation Commission, I was able to get the Court of Appeals to review a non-final order when they said that the unit rule would apply. And I said, under these circumstances, where the city has let this building deteriorate, that is not fair. You should permit us to prove the value of the lease. You should make an exception to the unit rule. The Court of Appeals denied that. And then we were forced to go through this elaborate trial. We knew that there was a problem here. We knew this from the very beginning. This jurisdictional offer was made in January of 2001. Immediately, I started an action under 3205 sub 5, challenging the right of the city to take the property because they had not provided comparable replacement property. We knew we were going to have a problem from the very beginning. And then subsequently, we made this petition for review of a non-final order. Unfortunately, the Court of Appeals decided that the unit rule would apply but didn't decide the constitutional issue, even though it had been raised in the trial court. That forced us to go through this terrible ritual of going through a jury trial where we knew we were at a huge disadvantage. The basis is that, I hope I'm responding to your question, the fact is that, and I think the Court of Appeals did well in just saying, wait a minute, under these facts, with complicity about, I don't know that there was complicity between Maharishi and the city, but it certainly worked out very well for both of them, because Maharishi got out from under this lease, and the city picked up this property for nothing. And the Court of Appeals is saying, under these circumstances, you may not use that unit rule to forfeit the value of the VFW lease, whatever that is, estimated at maybe $1 million in the brief. You may not forfeit that under these circumstances.
Mr. Brown, let me interrupt, if I might, for a minute. What do you want to see happen here? You want us, number one, to uphold the Court of Appeals, right?
Yes.
Does that mean that this case goes back for trial if we do that?
Yes.
And what would the issues be at trial?
The issue would be, what is the fair market value of that lease to the VFW on date of taking?
And your claim is that you've never had the chance to establish that because of the application of the unit rule.
Right. At the trial, you understand, we were not permitted to put in the value of this lease. We were only permitted to put in the value of the building. And arguably the building, as I said in my brief, the strongest piece of evidence in that whole trial was the fact that the city tore the building down. How could the jury come in with a value?
What approach do we take if we're to uphold your position in regard to the unit rule not applying here? What type of narrow exception should be drafted by the court, should be found by the court?
On those basic facts, that this was a structurally sound building, that the city deliberately or inadvertently refused to enforce its building code and let the building deteriorate. And under these circumstances, to do that to a structurally sound building bars them from enforcing the unit rule. Now, it's a factual exception. I think that's the way the Court of Appeals said it. I mean, this is facially outrageous what they did here.
Counsel, how do we use that when we're setting the law for the whole state? You're asking for us to have an exception to the unit rule that would justify valuing the VFW's leasehold interest separately from the fee simple. So, other than under the circumstances of this case, which doesn't allow much precedential value, how would you define the exception to the unit rule that you are requesting that we embrace?
Well, I think the exception to the unit rule is based on the facts of this case. And by the way, the Court of Appeals summarized all of the Wisconsin cases on the application of the unit rule. And they involve a series of three or four exceptions.
What exception justifies the separate valuation here, then?
Oh, the fact that the city declined to enforce its code requirements so that this building would have a value.
If I might, paragraphs, the Court of Appeals wrote a very interesting, good case, did exactly what you said. It went through all the cases that might touch on this. And then it said in paragraph 28, one paragraph, the particular circumstances requiring this conclusion include the fact that the leasehold interest here was long-term. How many years were left?
Oh, 160.
Okay, that's pretty long. That the lease did not include a forfeiture provision. Is that important to you?
I think so, yes.
Would you require, if you, the court went your way, would you put in forfeiture provision?
I'm not sure. In this case, the lease did not provide provision, did not provide for a forfeiture in the event of condemnation. And so I think that's significant. Because the Maxey case took up that whole issue. The Maxey case, by the way, is almost identical to this case. We haven't got to the Maxey case yet, but that's a case very similar to this, where the city of Racine, and I don't mean to avoid the question, the city of Racine, in advance of one of these redevelopment programs, pulled the license of the guy who owned this, Maxey, who owned this theater. It was an attempt to deflate the value of his theater. And he responded with an inverse condemnation action. And this court in 1980, courageously, I think, stepped forward and said, no, we are not going to permit you to do that. We're going to send this case back to the Racine Circuit Court and let Maxey prove up the value of his lease.
Well, the third point in 28 is that the fair market value of the property was found to be zero. So those are the circumstances that were summarized by the Court of Appeals. What would you add to that? I am a little troubled if those are the only three things.
I would add to that, number one, you may not apply the unit rule and the rule that condemnation terminates the obligation between lessor and lessee. Because if you do that, you eliminate the possibility of a recovery in these circumstances. That's number one. Number two, justification for the position of the Court of Appeals, is that the city of Milwaukee was responsible in significant ways for the deterioration of this building. And they did it just as they did it in Maxey. They did it in anticipation of the fact that they were eventually going to acquire this building and tear it down. Absolutely outrageous. I have suggested in the brief that this circumstances can prompt the conclusion that this is the worst abuse of condemnation powers in the history of the state of Wisconsin.
That's wrong.
And I think the Court of Appeals understood that.
Yeah, but they didn't say that, did they?
No, well, in their summary, they did not say that. But in their preliminary evaluation of this, they, I think, did recognize that these problems existed.
Counsel, let me ask, what if the city went in and said, there are all sorts of violations here? What if the landlord says, I don't care, I don't want to do anything with those? What does the city then do?
Well, again, I think that's a factual question that varies from time to time. I rely in this case on the fact that the engineers who testified in this case said that building structure is only 40 years old, it's reinforced concrete.
Right, but asbestos problems and other problems, things that you're saying the city should have come in. I'm just trying to figure out what the remedy would be there for the veterans. What's the remedy if the landlord still says, city, you can come in and tell me all these things are wrong with my building, I'm still not doing anything to it. What happens then to the vets?
Oh, I think they had the obligation to enforce, because here was the VFW.
Could be what? Do they take the property? They shut it down? Do they fine them? What do they do?
To correct all the code defects.
The city
if it needed
has
a new roof, it had to replace the new roof. If it needed new windows, it had to have new windows.
The city hires contractors to come in and do the work? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. I mean, the code enforcement is a procedure in which they would simply be drawn into court and required to do this. And here is the Maharishi Vedic University, Marquette University in town, really on the hook.
That's where I've seen it, when they end up in court and the person doesn't want to fix the property.
Oh,
and then what do you do with it?
They'll be fined to death until they do it. It's done on a regular basis. I mean, here we are at 26th and Wisconsin Avenue. What is the city doing letting this building deteriorate when there's substantial development all around the area?
So
they have a serious obstacle.
If the city would have fined them, would that then have been part of what would have ultimately come out of that?
Oh, the city should have taken these. They're all very substantial entities that made this commitment in this lease. to drag them all into court and say, you fix up that building, make it code compliant. Absolutely. There's no reason why they wouldn't have done that, except that they had adopted a redevelopment plan, and their plan was to level the area and make it available. Now, it didn't work for them because it's been vacant since 2003. But now their obligation here was to take this structurally sound building, only 40 years old, and bring it up to code. There were people living in this building, occupying it pretty much on a general basis, and there's no question that in the record, the usage of that 5,250 square feet was maybe not in all respects satisfactory to Greg, but that place was substantially usable. Look at the pictures in the record. It's a very attractive place. And all that was done by Zilber promising that they would have this build out, they'd provide the furniture. No taxes, no rent, you know the story, utilities. The marvelous arrangement for the BFW. It was it could develop into a headquarters for all the BFW units in the Milwaukee metropolitan area. What was it? There were people living in this building. What in the world is this city doing? The city was irresponsible. They were protecting their interest because they wanted to tear this building down. And they knew if they did that, they would have to pay more for the building.
Mr. Brown?
Yes.
First of all, we're going to have a warning, fire warning. Just a minute. Stay where you are. The noise varies from month to month, but it's very unpleasant, so we will not talk over it. We're just going to be quiet and proceed, so when it comes. But I was going to ask you, Mr. Brown, does the record show how much money you think this leasehold interest is worth?
I don't think that there's any positive. There were appraisals at the time of the Condemnation Commission hearing in 2002. There was an appraiser who testified that he felt that it was worth it. It's in the record. It's like $700,000 or $800,000.
Mm-hmm.
We did have in our, I think in one of the relocation claims, there was a combined appraisal, and also there was a C.G. Schmidt, an engineering firm in Milwaukee, estimated.
Remand would give you the opportunity.
We believe that at the remand, that number $1,000 and $1,200,000. If I may, just one thing, I'd like to conclude that the third factual reason that I believe that the Court of Appeal should be affirmed is this business about the raising. And I don't want to, it's in the brief,
okay.
But you should understand that the VFW was permitted to stay in this property from February 21st of 2001 until April of 2003. Now, we had resisted a writ of assistance in the meantime, but while all this was going on, the city was tearing this building down. And eventually, they resorted to getting a raise order out. Now, the final point that I make is simply this. If that building was as bad as they claim it was, they should have gotten the raise order out on February 21st of 2001. They should not have condemned it. If they would have gotten a raise order out against the Maharishi, Marquette, and Tom Wilde, the cost of tearing down that building, $727,000, would have been placed on the lessors. And there would have been no impediment to the VFW suing these lessors because that rule about termination of obligation between lessor and lessee does not apply in a raised situation. Thank you.
Justice Crawford, do you have a question?
No, that's cool.
Okay. Counsel?
Thank you. Well, listening to my colleague, I was searching my memory of the record facts. Nowhere can I remember from the voluminous record is there evidence of fact of wrongful, fraudulent, or illegal, or any other type of conspiracy between either the Redevelopment Authority or the City of Milwaukee and any owner of this property to knowingly devalue the property to save money in eminent domain. Nowhere in the record is there any fact of holding off deliberately on code enforcement so that the property can be devalued or colluding with the owners to that end. Nowhere. There's no conspiracy here, nor is there fact of that sort, as was just recited. Nor is there fact of that type in the record.
Sir, when you were up to bat before, I asked you what the property was valued at now, and your answer was that the Redevelopment Authority, you said, was not a authority that had to pay taxes. But that really wasn't the answer to the question that I asked. The question that I asked is there an assessed value for the property now? Do you know, is there?
There would not be an assessed value for government-owned property.
So they just don't put a value on it at all?
Correct. The last assessment was in 2001 for
$1,000. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
May I ask you, suppose I had had a 40-year lease in that building. On the second floor or another part of the first floor or something like that. I didn't pay anything for that lease. So I would understand under the unit rule, at least most of the time, that they just kick me out. I wouldn't have an interest, or minimal interest. Is it different that the lease interest of the VFW in effect it's been labeled as a prepaid interest?
No, there's not. Because whether you are occupying on the second floor for office space or whether the VFW is occupying 4% of the basement under a dollar a year prepaid, the fact of the matter is the unit rule in Chapter 32 provide for this. After the condemnor pays fair market value, that property is paid into court. And then the landlord and the tenant argue what their apportion should be. You would have an interest in your scenario. The VFW would have an interest, and they would have to argue what their interest is, what percentage of the unit rule value. The Court of Appeals here assumed payment of nothing. Not true. $300,000 paid sitting at Landmark Credit Union. There is not a payment of nothing. There is no fact of conspiracy here. Also, my brother of the council said that
they're okay with the unit rule. And we appreciate that, because so too are we, and that's the law in most states in the United States, and certainly in this state. They're okay with the unit rule so long as they can sue their landlord. Shifting the shaft. That's exactly what they want to do here. When this lease was negotiated in the 60s, the Redevelopment Authority wasn't a party to those negotiations. It was a business deal, a la the Walgreen case. What the VFW wants to do is it's making up this conspiracy theory, despite what the record shows. Oh, by the way, the redevelopment plan alluded to does not provide for raising of these structures.
Council,
it does not.
Would we create tremendous mischief if we said when the property is valued at zero, you can't use the unit rule because there will be no just compensation then paid?
Yes, you would be. That would violate the Redevelopment Authority's federal constitution and state constitution rights, and it would be against the United States Supreme Court's provision saying when the fair market value is nil, just compensation is nil.
Well,
it would be creating tremendous
mischief. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm asking you is, would we say that the unit rule may not be applied when the fair market value is determined by the appraiser or the evidence to be zero? And that's nothing to do with the Supreme Court case who said if the amount that it's assessed at is zero, you get zero. It's just whether the unit rule can be applied in those circumstances.
It would be
different.
It would be creating great mischief.
Okay.
Because what that question then would prompt, and what the VFW's whole position is a consequential damages for breach of lease case. That's the VFW's case. That's what your exception to the unit rule would be. There are no consequential or incidental damages in eminent domain. There is only constitutional just compensation, which cannot be looked at without regard to the fair market value of the property.
Well, if we adopted that zero rule that's proposed, your position as the city would be, hey, we got to get that up above zero. It's going to be worth at least $10,000, maybe only $500,000. But it's not zero. Mr. Brown's position would be it's worth zero. I mean, it was just the opposite of the usual position in condemnation, where the property being condemned wants it high, and the city wants the value low. But if you had a zero value, then you'd be fighting.
It would lead to that, and it would lead to condemnors having to analyze all the contractual interests. What about the mortgage holder who has a good rate of interest on the loan? What about the easement holder that is convenient to use that little strip of land for parking? What about the judgment lien holder or the material and supply lien? Where would it end? Condemnors need this for a public purpose. It's a drastic remedy. We don't use it willy-nilly. They need these properties for public purpose using public dollars. So it would create horrific problems. Back to the VFW's case in my rebuttal. Their case is that the shifting the shaft, as Justice Prosser said. Since they can't sue the landlord, they should be able to make Rackham pay, the condemnor, even though the condemnor was not a party to the business deal that's reflected in the lease. But the VFW's problem with lease enforcement was the VFW. It wasn't the lease. And I'll tell you why. This was a 1962 lease, November of 1962. The allegation made by the VFW in their case against the landlords, oh, and by the way, the VFW, when they sued, did not attach the lease to their complaint. But the allegation was the breach by the, oh, not only that, under a lease you have a 6-year statute of limitation period. And so how on earth could they sue Town Realty from the 60s? Not only that, there's a no implied covenant rule in Wisconsin under 706.10, sub 6. But they sued without attaching the lease on an implied covenant that they wanted to read into the 1962 lease that the landlords failed, quote, to maintain the property in a condition so it will have a value on February 28, 2001 of an amount sufficient to compensate the VFW for the value of its leasehold, close quote. That is what the court found to be frivolous. Now, we're not a guarantor of the lease. If the VFW wanted to sue its landlords under the Wisconsin Wall property case, it could have. It could have sued under lease page 3, number 4. The building shall comply with all local and state laws, regulations, and codes. That's an express term. Why didn't the tenant sue Maharishi Vedic for that actual express term in the lease? The VFW could have sued Maharishi Vedic under lease page 3, number 1. The VFW may use up to 20 parking spaces in the attached ramp. That attached ramp was unusable.
Okay, so why didn't they, in your opinion? Because you got a red light on, Counselor.
I don't know why, but the Redevelopment Authority should not be responsible for how they chose to plead their case against the landlords. Yet that's exactly what they want to do in seeking consequential damages of $1.2 million calculated in their briefs in a manner that will allow them to buy a brand new building, not a worn-out one with all sorts of code problems, a brand new building in some other location. Under Dottie, Midwest 2, that's consequential damages. They're not entitled to that. Relocation is limited by 32.19 and 32.195.
But Counselor, this is not a relocation case.
But that's what they want.
Well, that's not what we're here about. We're not here under the statute. We're here under just compensation, which is a different animal. Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hagopian. Thank you, Mr. Brown, for your arguments today in another condemnation, fair market value, just compensation case. This concludes our hearing in 06AP2866, City of Milwaukee, VFW Post number 2874 versus the Redevelopment Authority of the City of Milwaukee. We appreciate your good arguments today on both sides. And we will take a few moments recess so the people who wish to leave may do so, and we have other people coming in for the next argument. We're in recess for a few moments.